Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
P.J. O'Rourke. You know him from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me here on WNYC, from National Lampoon, from his 16 books, including bestsellers like Parliament of Whores and Give War a Chance, and a self-appointed role as the world's only trouble spot humorist. The title of his new book, as we listen to the theme from Leave It to Beaver, speaks for itself, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. PJ, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
It wasn't your fault you didn't cause the baby boom?
No, I was just born. You know, I mean, as we used to say very frequently to our parents, I didn't ask to be born.
Was it somebody's fault?
It must have been my parents' fault, yeah. You know, my parents would respond to that, I didn't ask to be born, by saying, funnily enough, we didn't ask for you either.
Oh, that's telling you more than you probably
wanted to know. Yeah.
It could have been Hitler's fault. Yeah. I've had that thought for causing World War II and making all the war veterans want nothing more exciting than to settle down and raise kids afterwards like no generation before.
There is something to that. If you look at what the parents, especially the parents of the first wave of the baby boom, because we're talking about 75 million people here, everybody born in America between 1946 and 1964. So we're talking, you know, so it's everybody from like Cher to Michelle Obama, you know. And so it's a broad range of people. But yeah, the greatest generation went through, not only did they go through World War II, enough you would think for any generation, but they had, before that, they had the Depression. And they grew up in a kind of an unstable period during the 1920s. You know, 1920s is fondly remembered, but it was actually a rather stressful period in American life. And so our parents, older baby boomers' parents, had known nothing but stress. And when the war was over and they moved to the suburbs, it was enough already, you know. Let's just have a nice quiet life.
A nice quiet life and have kids and kids and kids and kids.
Yeah, plenty of kids.
One problem you identify with the baby boom generation is the name. You say it could have had a cooler name.
Oh, yeah. I mean, wouldn't it be great to have been called the Lost Generation? I always loved the Lost Generation. Yeah. And but I think it's too late now. You know, we're described as exploding infants, you know, and it's done.
Nothing as romantic as the Lost Generation.
No.
I guess it came from a straightforward time, baby boom, when people used to call their companies things like U.S. Steel if they made steel in the United States.
You know, the big car company. You know, yes.
That was before names like Google and Amazon.
Yeah, let alone the names of prescription drugs these days. You know, you ever look at the names of prescription drugs, you look at these things and you go, what could it possibly do? You know,
if they created Google in the 1930s, they probably would have called it American Search Engine.
Yes. Yeah. Of course they would. Yeah. They'd want to seem like one of the big guys.
So have a lot of babies, call it the baby boom. You're right that there have been many generations in the past that had too many problems. The baby boom is the only one with too many solutions.
There's
a solutions glut?
There is something of a solutions glut. We are a generation – well, if we don't have a solution for everything, and obviously we don't, we certainly do have an excuse for everything. You know, we're very creative that way. It's interesting, you know, really the whole theme of my book is what happens when a generation of spoiled brats takes over, you know, and very fortunate generation of spoiled brats. Not very funny, but the single most interesting piece of research I found while I was doing this was median income between baby boomers, you know, kids born in the 40s and 50s, early 60s, and the median income of their parents when they're at the same age. And it's $10,000 in inflation-adjusted dollars, $10,000 chained dollars. We were $10,000. Our families, median, not average, but, you know, median where half of the families are above that and half below. Median families were $10,000 richer per year during the baby boom's childhood than they were during the greatest generation's childhood.
And again, not funny, but I think we're at a turning point in American history where the baby boom parents and even younger parents are not sure if their kids are going to be the first generation in American history to live less well. And
yeah,
that drives so much of our politics today.
I hope not. But yes, I think it is a legitimate fear that, you know, we used up a lot of things. I talk about how we used up the weird. You know, every generation needs to rebel against its parents. But when the generation after the baby boom, got to be teenagers, their parents had used up all the weird, you know. I mean, you know, we're
totally unfair to the kids.
Completely. You know, weird thoughts we thought them, you know, weird words we said them, you know, weird things we did them, you know, and weird clothes
maybe,
we wore them.
Maybe why the next generation, I think, actually turned out to be less rebellious than the baby boomers.
They did, but they're all pierced and tattooed, you know, and because they had to do something to rebel, and ouch, that must have hurt, and I apologize.
They're pierced and tattooed, but they're relatively happy to hang out with their parents.
Definitely our generation gets along with our kids much, much better than our parents' generation got along with us. In fact, that's still going on for those of us who have parents who are still living. You know, there are still tensions there.
Peach, go ahead.
Oh, it's just one of the things I wanted to explore in the book was actually how similar the Greatest Generation turns out to be to the baby boom. But the difference was that they did not have the opportunity or the means to act on their feelings, and we did it with both hands. And that's one of the things that led to the tension between Archie and Meathead.
P.J. O'Rourke, our guest on WNYC, his new book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. And listeners, I think we can take two kinds of calls for P.J. O'Rourke. Mostly, we can see this as ask a baby boomer. So if you are not a boomer but have always been curious about something, about actually being a baby boomer, we have an actual one here as our guest willing to answer questions.
We have two in the room.
One who has written a book about the experience of being a baby boomer and set himself up as an expert.
You bet.
So
yeah.
Think of it as kind of an anthropological call-in. What have you always wanted to ask a baby boomer but never one – had one at hand to ask. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or you can post your question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Or if you're a boomer, call in and tell us if the baby boom was your fault and if you'll ever do it again. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, let's see.
Don't text us, though, because we don't understand that stuff.
You can tweet us. Yeah. You can post on Facebook. Yeah. Actually, we're not set up to take texts. But anyway, you recall the punishment that baby boom children were given in school to leave the classroom and sit in the hall. Why did you include that in the book?
Did you have that?
Yeah, sure.
And I think it was because we've always been such a social and gregarious generation. Yeah, I mean, you know, we grew up in those of us who went to public school, which is most of us, in these very crowded classrooms. I got out my third grade class photograph, and I kept losing count. You know, I think there were like 42 kids in that class. And you would think that being sent out into the hall would have been a relief, you know, from this crowded and noisy classroom, but not for baby boomers, you know, being separated. It was like the worst possible punishment. You'd sit out in the hall and feel sorry for yourself.
And you suggest that may have given rise to a particular baby boom parenting tool when they grew up and had kids.
The time out. You know, I had kids late, so I spent a long time as a bachelor without kids. And I remember I'm walking through an airport one time, and I hear this person about my age saying to a young kid, "If you don't behave, you're going to get a time out." And I thought, you know, as a busy adult, I thought, gee, I'd love a timeout.
Yeah. Well, can your employer give you a timeout?
Yeah, please. But you know, I had never heard the phrase before, and I never really thought about the concept. And the kid would have to sit still, essentially be sent into the hall, just like we were. And, of course, with baby boom parents, the Generation X kid or the millennial kid was probably thinking, please, Mom, make it two. You know? Leave me alone.
Back-to-back timeouts.
Yeah.
One is punishment.
With helicoptering. And one is pleasure.
And one is therapy. Yeah. Now, any book about the baby boom generation has to mention Leave It to Beaver, and we played the theme going in, and you don't disappoint.
Did you watch the Beaver
as a kid?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was, you know, Beaver was portrayed, I suppose I felt like in between Wally and Beaver. Wally was a late silent generation child, and Beaver was a – and I totally identified with the show.
And you ask even – well, you compare the depiction of middle-class life in Leave It to Beaver – to that in Shakespeare.
I do. One of the things is that Leave It to Beaver takes such a beating. It takes such a sort of critical beating. It's kind of like a byword for everything that was square and stupid about the 50s and everything that was like saccharine and hypocritical and, you know, anodyne. And if you actually look at – if you watch it, Leave It to Beaver – they're cute little television plays, and they kind of teach a nice lesson, and people they're cleverly written. They're very well acted. The production values are good, and I'm thinking, okay, why is this such a terrible thing? Leave It to Beaver, such a terrible thing, and Shakespeare's the Merry Wives of Windsor is like great art. Now that's a depiction of middle class life, and middle class life seems to have been a lot sleazier in Elizabethan times, as far as we can tell from the Merry Wives of Windsor. There's Falstaff, you know, and you know, all sorts of embarrassing and probably unradioable behavior in the Merry Wives of Windsor. And plus, think about it, which would you really rather sit through?
Yeah.
Especially if it's a high school production.
First book ever, I'm sure, to compare The Merry Wives of Windsor and Leave It to Beaver on
I think I might have that distinction.
Moral turpitude scale. Yeah. Let's see. Who wants to talk to P.J. O'Rourke? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Louise in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Brian. Happy New Year.
You too.
And, P.J., I listened to you all the time on Wait, Don't Tell Me. I just wanted to say that I don't know if you experienced the public school education. I experienced the private school, Catholic school education,
where
we had up to about 60 kids in the classroom.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was no chaotic atmosphere or noise. It was very controlled.
You got your knuckles smacked.
There was certainly punitive action taken if anyone misbehaved.
Yeah, Catholic school was like public school with hitting, you know,
<That's>
from the teachers. Yeah, because I had a lot of, you know, being Catholic, being Irish, I went to public school, but I had plenty of friends that went to Catholic school, and it was like we always sort of felt sorry for them. Among other things, the Friday fish in the cafeteria was notoriously terrible.
Was the fish terrible?
I'm sorry, it couldn't be.
Did they serve fish for lunch that was terrible on Fridays?
No, there was
Fridays?
No cafeteria.
No, there was no cafeteria. Oh, no.
I walked home for lunch every day.
Oh.
Louise, thank you. Harry in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hello, Harry.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a quote-unquote baby boomer. And just a historic note, I don't know if it was on that old Walter Cronkite series of 20th Century, if it was a book or an article, but originally we were called the war babies, and at some point in time, either a media article, I guess via a census count, or a book, then began referring to us as the baby boomers.
It was a Time magazine article. It was a Time magazine article because I looked this up, you know, in the process of writing the book. It turned out to be not a very interesting story. It was just, you know, a Time magazine.
How long did it take? How early was it?
The Time magazine article was about early 50s. I no longer remember the exact date.
So that's a while. That's more than 5 years after the war.
It was, yeah. And I don't think the baby boom really came into more common use until around the end of the 50s and beginning of the 60s, when we were making ourselves felt demographically, pressure on the public school system, stuff like that.
And I think war babies is a term to refer to people who were born during the World War II years, usually,
well,
right?
Well, sort of sounds that way, doesn't it? Even if that wasn't what was meant. And also, I mean, of course, you could have I guess we would have had to have been called stoned anti-war babies. It won't be got to a certain
stage. Could be
stage.
Called that. Certainly, if you maybe not Marilyn Quayle, but
no,
many could.
But many could. Yeah.
Maureen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Maureen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I have two questions, actually. My my husband is a baby boomer, and I'm a Gen Xer, so we're 22 years apart.
So it's a mixed marriage.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And we could tell you're not a baby boomer because your sentences end up.
That's right.
Yes,
they
yes,
do.
I do try to stop that, but, you know, it's not helping. And he hates it when I say, duh. And he, I'm trying not to use the word like as much.
But you have a question? Yes.
Both my husband and my parents tell me, I was interested when you guys said, you know, we're the spoiled generation. So when I watch things like Mad Men, I can see that reflected in the media. But my experience from both my parents and my husband is, oh, you know, our parents, you know, if we were alive and had shelter, then that was good enough. We didn't get coddled. We didn't get played with, you know. I grew up on a farm, and I had 11 brothers and sisters, and
I had to walk 40 miles to school,
exactly.
And shower flip flops,
yeah.
And you liked it.
Yeah. Every generation does that to every younger generation, you know, and they're all lying.
So they're lying to me.
They're just lying.
Did you say you had another question?
Yes, and my other question was: do you guys get the feeling that with the age difference, with the wide group of the baby boomers and how spread out they are in their age differences, I'll notice, like, my husband and my father are 10 years apart, thank God. And my father falls in with some of my husband's older siblings, and they'll kind of like the same music, and my husband will sort of joke, like, oh, that's sort of dorky, you know, music.
Totally, totally. In fact, I go on about that at some length, as a matter of fact, because when you have across that time span that many people, you have to divide them up somehow, and I'm trying to figure out how to divide these people up. And, you know, it's not a baby boom way to divide people up by ethnic group or race or religion or place where they lived or even by social class. But you can definitely
do it for inclusion rather than exclusion.
Exactly. It has to be done for inclusion. So we're a very inclusive generation. So I did it by time. I did senior class, junior class, sophomore class, freshman class. In the junior class are people like me. You know, we were born in right after the war, end of the 40s. And we were both, you know, kind of in the vanguard of that 60s rebellion. But we were also – we were more closely tethered to, as usually the first children – of the greater generation parents. And so we ended up being, in effect, sort of keel-hauled on this voyage, you know, and we turned out a little like strange and soggy, you know, with investment advisors with nose rings, you know, and Trotskyites trying to start Tea Party movements. And, you know, so I pointed out that Cheech Marin and Hillary Clinton are both members of that senior class. You know.
Born in the late 40s. Yeah. And so what about all the way on the opposite end of the spectrum, the freshmen
who are
practically Gen Xers, too young to take drugs in the 60s because they were born in the 60s.
Well, no, they weren't too young to take drugs. Well, no, they were too young to take drugs in the 60s. Yes, in a lawyerly way, you were right. They weren't too young to take drugs. I believe there was something called the Shroom Gang or Shoom Gang in Hawaii, a well-known president of the United States whose name will not be mentioned. The youngest baby boomers kind of grew up with all the baby boom sort of worldview and habits and behaviors as just givens. That was just the way the world was. They didn't see it created, you know. And if they remember at all, something like the Vietnam War was just something that was inexplicably on TV all the time, like Ed McMahon, you know.
Here is Tim in Bergen County, born in 66, with a grievance.
With a grievance, okay. Yeah, okay. You
Tim,
have a
correct,
right.
With a
you
grievance?
You have a right to one, Tim.
Tim, you there?
Yes, I am, sir. How are you?
Hi.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rourke. I just want to say I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank
you. My grievance is that I grew up primarily in the 1980s, and we were always looked back at the kids who grew up in the 70s, and they had all the fun, and we weren't left anything to do. All the fun styles and the wild parties, and we are growing up seemed rather mundane.
Yeah. Not you grew up, it was sort of rather mundane, drugs, you know, it was just say no. And not only that, but sexually transmitted diseases had been discovered, you know. And so, yeah, I'd like to tell you, you know, that we were just like pulling your leg about how much fun we had back then. And you actually had more fun than we did, you know, but that wouldn't be true.
Because you really did have the
you
fun.
We did really use up all the fun, yeah.
Tim, thank you, and
we're sorry.
It's, you know, it's good.
We'd
to
give
apologize.
That fun back if we could. You know,
this is the week of the apology, and yeah.
My liver would give that fun back if it could.
Did you go to Woodstock?
I tried to. I tried to. I came. I rode my motorcycle out from Ohio, where I was from, to meet this girl in New York that I had a terrific crush on. And she and I were going to ride up to Woodstock. Now, Woodstock, mind you, nobody had any idea it was going to turn out the way it did. It had been advertised in sort of the record stores and in hip places in Ohio. I know that sounds, you know.
Contradictory.
Yeah. But you know, Yellow Springs, Ohio, was where Antioch College was. You know, there were hippish places in Ohio. And the way Woodstock – I was sort of picturing a folk music hootenanny with a, you know, kind of wind chime sail, you know, maybe a surprise appearance by Mimi Farina. And so we were going to go up on my motorcycle, which would still be in the mud in upstate New York if we had tried. And the young lady picked that weekend to make what I got to say was like a very sort of notional suicide attempt.
Oh.
It wasn't a suicide attempt like kids make today. It was like emptying the family medicine cabinet back when the family medicine cabinet had Midol and some vitamins and, you know,
heavy stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And so she had to have her stomach pumped.
Reasons I didn't go to Woodstock.
Yeah. And so I abandoned my plans to go to Woodstock. I was particularly upset because the suicide attempt had not been over her wild romantic passion for me, but over a fight with her mother about a charge, I think a peasant blouse, a $100 peasant blouse had been charged on the Bloomingdale charge card, you know, the charge plate.
I couldn't go on after that.
Yeah, no, yeah, me either.
I do think, 500,000 boomers were at Woodstock, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah,
but 500 million now claim they were at Woodstock.
Oh, yes, yes. It's very rare to meet. You know, it's a little, I think there was a period like that after World War II about Marines at Guadalcanal, uh-huh. Something like 300% of the Marine Corps had been at Guadalcanal or Iwo Jima.
And no one ever admits they had the bad acid.
Yes, exactly. That they had to go to the bummer tent.
We will leave it there with P.J. O'Rourke. You know him from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and all kinds of other stuff. And his new book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, 50-year predictions, part two. Yesterday we heard Isaac Asimov's for 2014. Today we'll hear what leading futurists and what you are predicting for 2064. What will life be like for your grandchildren or, depending on your age, their grandchildren? Stay with us.
By the time we got to Woodstock, we were half a million strong.